Greetings, Earth explorers, and welcome to X-Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. Here, the results are always positive. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, we discuss the mysteries of the universe. When we are done, you will never look at the stars or yourself the same again. Whether you are in a truck headed for the coast or in a car driving across the frosty desert tonight or working in your garage on your favorite project, as you listen, you are about to learn more about where you came from, why you are here, and where you are going than you ever thought possible. In here, your potential is absolutely unlimited. Tonight on X Squared Radio, we're going to interview J. Brian Boldman, the world's best expert on angel hair. If you don't know what angel hair is and what its relationship is to UFO activity on planet Earth, you need to stay tuned because this will be the show that will tell you what it's all about. And, of course, while you're here, we want you to know that the Arc of Millions of Years is the greatest story on the universe. Volume 1 solves the mystery of evolution and creation once and for all. In its 530 pages, you will learn about the origin and destiny of the Earth. You will learn about the ancient giants and their fathers, the Nephilim. You will learn about man's long history of interaction with off-worlders. You will learn the common origin of many of mankind's most powerful religious symbols. When you are done with that book, you will never look at the stars, your scriptures, or yourself the same again. Remember, it's available at www.arcofmillionsofyears.com. Make sure to spell that A-R-K like Noah's Ark. And tonight, when you go to that website, make sure you put in the code word STAR, S-T-A-R, and you'll get free shipping. Or you can pick the book up at your local Barnes & Noble store or Joseph Beth Booksellers, and now in Davis Kidd Booksellers in Nashville, Memphis, and Jackson, Tennessee. Well, we certainly welcome you tonight, my great listeners, and we also want to welcome J. Brian Boldman, the world's best expert on angel hair. Welcome, Brian.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. I always like to get this data out because it is not very well known, and I think that it's something of great importance that people do need to know about.
Well, it's true, and I had the great privilege of being at a conference this weekend where Brian was speaking on the subject of angel hair, and although he didn't have a lot of time, he did put forth a lot of excellent evidence on the presence of angel hair. So why don't you, in just a few minutes here, tell us what angel hair is, and then we'll dig right into the evidence.
Okay, sure. Well, I got interested in angel hair about 1995, so I've been doing this research about 10 years. Of course, before that, I had my own UFO sighting in 1989, and it was kind of mystified that there was no physical evidence, and it turns out that there is a lot of it, angel hair being one example. It's actually a CE2 classified by J. Allen Hynek, Close Encounter of the Second Kind. That is where a UFO leaves a trace or a residue. And in my research, I did an extensive literary survey and found about 260 cases of angel hair, and in those cases, about 60% of them involve UFO sightings.
How about that? So they're pretty tied together.
They are very well tied together. Not only that, there was another correlation besides just UFOs dropping angel hair. It's also prominent during two UFO waves. 1954 was the largest by far. I must have, I guess, 2 to 3 dozen cases from that wave alone, and then in 1973, the United States experienced a UFO wave in October, loaded with angel hair cases as well.
Huh, so they are not just localized into in one area or one time.
Oh, no. Angel hair has been reported on every continent except for Antarctica. And that could just be simply due to the population density there. There's simply nobody there to report it.
Not many people other than polar bears around to see it fall.
Yeah,
well, can you
right.
give us can you give us some specifics? Give us maybe a 19 what did you say 1954?
That was a huge angel hair wave, primarily in Europe, France, and Italy specifically. But this stuff has been happening. I've even got cases going back into the 16th and 17th century. Here I'm looking at my notes. And actually, Charles Fort, if your listeners are familiar with who he was and what he did, actually documented several cases during the 19th century where this stuff fell. One case, 1820, Liverpool, England, this substance came down. And maybe I should give a brief description of what angel hair looks like and the physical properties that it has.
Sure, because we might have some listeners that may have seen some of this.
Absolutely. It's generally described as a very fine, white, web-like substance. And it has the unusual property of sometimes just vanishing, especially when it's captured in a hand or picked up by the hand. It just disappears. And I think what's actually happening is that it's sublimating. It's going from a solid to a gas.
Well, that's kind of interesting to me as a degree chemist, because one of the ways that we identify unknown substances is with qualitative tests. And one of our most favorite field tests, qualitative tests, is melting point, sublimation point. Is there any good data on if there's a specific temperature or humidity level at which this stuff disappears?
Actually, I'm working on that right now, and I guess you're getting at the triple point.
The triple point. Oh, yes, the place that where our listeners who are not chemists, if you know what an azeotrope is, there is a point at which a substance can be a liquid, gas, and solid at the same time. This is the point at which a solid can go directly to a gas, kind of like dry ice. It doesn't actually melt. It just more or less goes straight from solid ice to evaporated CO2 gas.
That's right. That's my understanding as well. And I think that this triple point, the point where this substance will turn from a solid to a gas, at ambient temperatures on the surface must be right above the actual ambient temperature, because people have described handling angel hair and it will actually ball up away from their hands. And I think that their latent heat of their hands is causing stuff to actually do that and to eventually sublimate to a gas.
Well, sure. I mean, body temperature at the skin for hands being one of the extremities is probably about 85 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit, about somewhere around 36 degrees C, and that's certainly above what we would consider ambient temperature. Ambient temperature in a lab or normal temperature is somewhere around 73 or 74 degrees Fahrenheit, which would be about 23 degrees C.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well, and I also think that If, for instance, this stuff is generated by UFOs at an altitude, say 20,000 feet, well, of course, the temperature at altitude is going to be very, very substantially cooler.
Oh, sure.
And at the surface, it's
at 20,000 feet, your outside temperatures can be anywhere from 20 to 40 below zero.
That's right. I'm a private pilot, and they call that the adiabatic lapse rate.
Uh-huh.
And I think it drops off about 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit every 1,000 feet, something like that.
That's about right. And it kind of depends on what time of year it is. Obviously, if it's 0 degrees at the ground, it's not. It only gets to about 60 below, even at 40,000 feet. But you have a tremendous temperature drop. If you don't believe me, just drive up to the mountains someday in California. You'll be skiing in Mammoth and surfing that afternoon in Santa Monica.
And another point, if you've ever flown, well, for instance, I took a flight from North Carolina, where I live, to the West Coast on Delta, and they now have on their screens, I believe this was a 767, they actually had the outside air temperature posted on the monitor there, and I believe it was minus 45 this past summer going out to California, so that just shows you.
Yeah, that's summertime.
That's summertime, that's right.
So, now, the general composition of angel hair, are we talking about a polypeptide protein like spider webs, or are we talking about cotton candy?
Well, that's what I think differentiates true angel hair from spider webs, the fact that it does not contain the, like you said, spider web is a polypeptide protein. It's very strong stuff. And, of course, doesn't sublimate. My garage and basement is a classic example of that.
let's just a little bit of the chemistry. We like to get into a little bit on the show. We have very sophisticated listeners.
I think that it's a long-chain polymer, and I'm looking right now for, okay, here it is. I can read you we had an FTIR or a Fourier transform infrared spectrometry test done.
Yeah, that's my area of expertise. By the way, FTIR, a Fourier transform, is a mathematical way of treating frequency occurrences like a histogram so that it can be mathematically treated a little better, more digitally than an analog signal like the old systems. They're quite fast, and the mathematics is, well, if you passed PCAM, you'll know what it is.
Right.
Anyway, FTIR, infrared, there are three different ranges that are used, and the most common for FTIR is what's called mid-IR, or about 1,053 nanometers as the laser source.
Okay, and I will read you what the chemist that analyzed this actually said was in it. She states, some current spectra indicate 2-methylpropane, 2-methyl-1-propene, 2-methyl-1-butene, 2-methylpentane, 3-methylpentane, hexane, dimethylpentane, and some hydrocarbon structures. She states specific isomers unidentified. She did find one C8H16 hydrocarbon, molecular weight 112. Also indicated are carbonyl sulfide, or COS, and carbon disulfide, or CS2. And she states that there are possibly heavier hydrocarbons present, such as 2 C20H42 components, as well as a C23H43 component.
Well, that sounds a little bit to me like fatty acids, or maybe even sugar.
I've actually been told it's also like a gasoline-type derivative.
Not quite long enough. Interestingly enough, I did a research paper, I'm going to say 10 years ago, on planetary interaction with cometary tails. In ancient times, and in recent times, we've had close encounters with comets. Now, normally, what we see is the head. You know, it shears ice crystals off that are boiled away by the sun, and we see it as Hale-Bopp, or we see it as Halley's Comet. But
right, and generally, they're only within, what, about 0.5 AU or something like that before they actually start to sublimate their...
Exactly. And you know, our good friend Jupiter absorbs a lot of those cometary heads by attracting them with its immense gravity, and they end up slamming into the surface after they succumb to the Roche limit and come apart. But that million-mile-long tail from that comet keeps coming around on the regular basis that the comet normally came. That's where we see the Leonids and the Persids. This is all junk that was left by the cometary head that's still orbiting around on that cometary tail. Well, that tail is made up of trillions of cubic yards of methane, which, you know, is a single carbon atom. Maybe some of it has enough energy to form a couple of carbons, say to ethane or maybe propane. But when it comes into the atmosphere, it's sort of like, you know, when you walk up to a doorknob in the wintertime and you have leather shoes on and you touch that doorknob. Or you get out of your car and you touch the ground and then you go to hit that door lock and it shocks the fire out of you. Mm-hmm. Well, there is a voltage, a potential that builds up between the methane cloud and Earth. So as the methane cloud begins to interact with the upper atmosphere, huge amounts of electricity are poured into that cloud. Well, when it happens, it forms these long-chain hydrocarbons, and it falls to the ground in great strands, ribbons, like a white gossamer kind of hoarfrost, and it lands on the ground, and of course, as soon as the sun comes out, it either sublimates or melts away into the ground. But we really believe this is where most of the crude oil comes from on our planet, is millions of years of interaction with these cometary tails. And we're talking oceans and oceans full of methane that are subjected to these high discharge electrical charges. Now, I'm not saying that's where angel hair comes from, but it sounds awfully like the chemical properties of that that substance.
That is fascinating. You're telling me then that the I guess I'd always thought that oil came from dinosaurs.
Yeah, no, that's a myth. It has been blown apart probably pretty recently, but I've known about it for a long, long time. When I put my spectrographic systems together in the early 80s, I did radio spectroscopy of the Earth for the oil and gas industry, and now it's commonly called ground probing radar now, but in those days we didn't have digital equipment, but we had to do analog analysis of wave distortions from radio waves that we beamed into the ground, and that's how we identified natural gas, crude oil, water, shale, coal, things like that in the ground. And in fact, that's exactly the same technology that was designed to run in Mars Express. I submitted that in 1998 to NASA.
Fascinating. So I guess the little Sinclair Dino fella kind of, he needs to go bye-bye.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's oil doesn't come from dinosaurs. Maybe some tar sands may have come from ancient lake beds, but we're drilling down to, 18,500 feet, and there aren't any dinosaurs down there. And by the way, we're not running out of oil. It's constantly generated.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that you're saying that comets or comet debris has caused these oil fields. And I've also read that there's a theory about comet panspermia actually bringing life to the Earth.
Mm-hmm. Especially if comets can be all kinds of junk, but usually they're made of several hundred thousand tons of ice. And this can be formed from shattered planets that come apart during supernova events or collisions with other free-floating planets. And their oceans of these planets get splattered out into space and they freeze quickly. And all of the microbial life in that sea or that lake sort of goes into suspended animation. And then when it's reconstituted by melting into another terrestrial ocean somewhere, that life comes right back and begins to propagate.
Well, that's fascinating to me because I also remember reading that there is a theory that a lot of our water has come from comets and possibly enough to fill the oceans.
Well, I've read similar theories and theories about Noah's flood, how it might have been a collision with an ice asteroid. However, none of the surviving observations tend to back that up, and we'll just see how that plays out. But
right, sure.
In the meantime, it does look very feasible that a high voltage interaction with some kind of fuel could very well exhaust this exact kind of polymer.
There is a thing, a fellow named Planter. Are you familiar with him?
The peanut guy?
No, not the peanut guy.
I'm
he was
kidding.
A French guy. Okay, here's a quote that was in Amy Michelle's book, The Truth About Flying Saucers. Now, this guy, Planter, he was a French Air Force lieutenant. And in Michelle's book, he writes, "For according to Planter, the ionization of the atmosphere in the wake of the craft would be sufficient because of the colossal intensity of the field to produce ultra-heavy positive particles, which in contact with the molecules of oxygen, nitrogen, water, etc., of the surrounding air would exhibit novel chemical reactions. The product of these reactions, the famous angel's hair, would disintegrate as the ionization disappeared."
Very interesting. For those of you listeners who are not familiar with our earthly processes where we use this kind of technology, we commonly, very commonly, use ultraviolet light to cause what we call a dimerization of an ester. It actually breaks apart a urethane molecule, giving off CO2 gas and forming long chain polymers with different kinds of alcohol, or what we call polyols or organic material or different monomers, and it all becomes one molecule. It becomes cross-linked, and we use it with glue, and we use it with printing plates and even paint. So it's all kinds of UV curable processes where we use this. And I'm going to use a word that I'm sure you've heard on a diet program somewhere. It's a free radical. A free radical is a molecule or an ion that has an extra electron. It's just aching to react with something. And in your body, that's not a good thing, because it reacts with your own tissue and ends up breaking it apart. But in chemical reactions, we use this all the time. And it would seem that if you're going to subject whatever fuel that UFOs use or whatever field they generate, it has got to use either an extremely strong magnetic field or, which would probably go with it, a very strong electrical field or electromagnetic field. And if that's the case, you've got all the making for creating free radicals, which is how this how these complex compounds are made.
It's interesting because there have been so many EM reports associated with UFO sightings.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And not only that, but I think infrared radiation is also involved with them. But I think the prevailing theory now on angel hair, most people that have researched this have come up with, it's some sort of residue from a propulsion system of some sort.
Sort of like biodegradable exhaust.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. Well, what other properties does it exhibit? Does it, has anybody captured some and kept it, or does it?
Yes.
I mean,
oh, yes. It sublimates in about 40% of the cases that I have.
Wow.
So it's quite a number. However, the cases where it has not sublimated, we've actually gotten, let's see now, I think there's about 12 to 14 samples that have been recovered and analyzed. But, of course, now most of these were done early on before we had, FTIR or a gas chromatography, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they did chemical analysis.
So what? Now, I know that gas chromatography, so do they, well, I guess I'm going to ask you kind of a broad question here. Since we have some history, some analytical history, we've got to have some sampling history, too. You know, what is the, if one of our listeners should happen to find some of this stuff, and keep in mind you're reaching about 2 million listeners a day, how would they go about picking this stuff up where they know they could preserve it so that they could call you or call in here and we can get a hold of you and get this evidence into your hands?
Absolutely. I appreciate you asking that, because this is what we really need. We need good, clean, sterile, uncontaminated samples. This is very important to really track this stuff down and find out what it's really doing, how it's produced. We need to have good samples. And I would say this. I suggest to people, if they see this stuff falling in their yard or if they're driving along, be creative, but be sterile. I would suggest if you can get, say, a drinking straw in a wrapper, well, that's sterile. Just unwrap it, collect this stuff, and put it in a sterile Ziploc baggie.
You mean sort of like wrapping it up like cotton candy or something?
Yeah, wrap it up and store. Don't touch it.
Uh-huh.
Store it in a clean, sterile container. And then I might suggest, I wouldn't say put it in your freezer because this stuff could have some caustic effects, but get a bag of ice at a convenience store and just shove it right in the middle of that, and that will slow down the sublimation.
Now, what kind of container? I mean, most people don't drive around with a sterile glass jar in their car, but what could they use?
Oh, you know, I do. People think I'm not doing it, but I actually do. You know, you never know. I would say, you know, buy some Ziploc baggies.
Ziploc bags, that's a good one. Okay.
And put it in there and just make sure that it's not contaminated with anything. If you can get a clean sample that's, say, not, you know, been in some sort of contact with something that would contaminate it, because that's going to throw off the analysis.
Mm-hmm.
We need a clean sample, and then we can get some good results.
Okay. Well, listen, let's just take a real quick break here. I got to do a commercial, and then I want to know how to get your, if you have a book, you got a book coming out, or you're working on one. We'll talk about that for a couple minutes, and then we'll take some phone calls, because I know there are people out there that want to ask some questions.
Good enough.
All right, you know, last December, my co-author E.J. Clark and I published a book called The Ark of Millions of Years, and actually, we didn't think it would sell too well. We thought it would just kind of sit out there on the shelves, but unbeknownst to us and much to our surprise, in about 60 days, it was a bestseller. And that's because The Ark of Millions of Years explains why the Mayan calendar, the Aztec calendar, ends at the year 2012. Not only that, the detail in the book will help you understand why the Earth is going through such changes right now. Tidal waves, volcanoes, earthquakes, strange weather patterns, melting ice caps. Is the Earth really warming? Yes. In fact, all the planets in our solar system are warming. You want to know why? Then you got to read the book. Is the Earth from this solar system? Not entirely. Want to know the proof? You got to read the book. Are we alone in the universe? No. You want to know who they are and why they have always been so interested in our planet? Then you got to read the book. It's always available at www.arcofmillionsofyears.com. Make sure you spell that like Noah's Ark. I have a lot of people put N-A-R-C and not get anywhere. Or, and by the way, if you go to the website as you're listening tonight, you can put in the code word STAR, STAR, and you will get free shipping anywhere in the continental United States. Or you can pick it up at Barnes & Noble, Joseph Beth, or Davis Kidd Booksellers. And now we'll get back to our guest, J. Brian Boldman. So, Brian, are you working on a book?
Oh, yes. It's been in work now for about 3 years. I've also written some articles, which your listeners can actually read an article I had published in International UFO Reporter on the net. It's a PDF file, and they can get, there's a link to that on my website, which doesn't have much on there yet, but in the future I plan on expanding that dramatically.
Well, why don't you tell us what your website link is, and maybe we'll provide you a little help to beef that website up so we can get some traffic going.
Oh, sure. Well, it's very simple. It's just angelhair.info. That's one of the new domains they have now, because I guess .com is getting too full. As a matter of fact, angelhair.com is a beauty salon in Los Angeles, so I tried to get that one first. And
all right, but you still do www.
I think most browsers don't even, you know, you don't have to put the www anymore.
Well, but, I'm glad, because I sure am tired of saying www. I can't even say it. It's a tongue tire for me. I'm not an expert at this.
Yeah, well, neither am I, obviously, but, you know, I think that either one, but I think most browsers, I use Internet Explorer, and, you know, angelhair.info works just fine.
Wonderful. All right, that's it, angelhair.info. All right, listeners, if you want to call in, we don't screen our telephone calls. I believe in total freedom of communication. However, if you get too crazy or don't fit what we consider to be FCC guidelines, we're going to say thank you for the call. So we'll take them as fast as you can call in and as fast as we can get your point. The number is toll-free anywhere in the United States, 888-268-4313, 888-268-4313, X Squared Radio. And our guest, J. Brian Boldman, and his subject, angel hair. And I believe it is possibly the best evidence of UFO activity on the Earth today. Now, I got to ask you, we've talked about FTIR, we've talked a little bit about gas chromatography. Maybe some people don't know what that is. We sort of run hydrogen gas through a flame. We burn a flame at the end of a long drinking straw. On the inside of that drinking straw, we have a coating called a column or a media. And we draw through that hydrogen gas that is laden with, and I'm going to use the word nebulized, sample. And that column stretches out the compounds in your sample based on its affinity with that coating. On the other end, when it comes out into the flame, obviously it burns. And when it burns, it gives off a signal that's picked up by a detector, usually called a flame ionization detector. And it's wonderful because you can separate out your compounds. If you want to try this at home, you can put a dot of ink on a piece of paper, drop the end of that piece of paper into a small cap full of alcohol, and let the other end of the paper stick straight up in the air, and you'll see that ink separate out as that alcohol crawls up that water, up the paper. That's chromatography. Well, it's interesting to use, but you have to have standards to run through that GC. If you have standards and you know how long they take to get through that column, we call that elution time, then when you run your unknown through there, you can match it up with those unknowns or with the standards. And that's how you can do qualitative analysis with a gas chromatograph. And you could do some quant too with it, but we're not going to get into that tonight. So we've done FTIR, we've done GC. What about microscopic examination? Has anybody looked at this stuff under a microscope?
Sure. As a matter of fact, the person that has done my analysis, and I might as well give her a plug, because she's done a wonderful job for me and UFOs, UFO researchers in general. Her name is Phyllis Budinger. And as a matter of fact, she actually analyzed Betty Hill's dress, if you're familiar with the Betty Hill abduction, up in New Hampshire. She's done some amazing work, and she has a Leica, a very expensive microscope, and looked at this stuff, and it's very small fibrils. Some of them are just a few microns in width, and compared it with spider web, and it's definitely dissimilar. Spider web is thicker, and not only that, it has the capture glue droplets on it. Which are not present in angel hair. And also, angel hair, these little fibrils are in bundles. They're very straight bundles, and spider web, if you look at it under a microscope, it's knotted and kind of gnarly. It's tangled. It's not just straight fibrils. And angel hair almost looks like a synthetic type of textile fiber.
Huh, how about that? Do you have micrographs or microscopic pictures on your website?
Not yet. I'm working on that. Right now, I've just got the basic website up and some basic information, and I do have some news clipping links. If people want to go to their local library and actually find some articles that were written up about this in their local papers, they can possibly find a citation there they can use.
Wow. Fascinating. Well, I definitely want to see some micrographs of this stuff. So when you're saying it looks kind of like a fabric or a yarn or a thread of something,
that's
very interesting. So I guess the stuff is flammable then.
Yes. Well, it can be. And I might add that angel hair has been analyzed, like I said, about 14 times now that I know of. Now, most of these are early analysis back in the 50s.
Oh, really?
I've got some samples here. If you'd like to, now, these were probably just, rudimentary analysis. This is probably not in depth. But October 53 in Victoria, Australia, a sample was recovered and made available for laboratory analysis. The examination revealed that the substance consisted of a nylon-like amorphous mass with traces of magnesium, calcium, boron, and silicon.
Boron?
Boron. Now, that I found that in four other separate cases. You know, they were separated both temporally and geographically.
Well, that's not completely organic then, is it?
No, it's also been found. Yeah, that's right. There's one analysis from Portugal, which, of course, I had to kind of translate. But it consisted of an inorganic and organic content.
Wow. Now, that is where FTIR is very, very helpful. Because, you know, when somebody tells me, oh, we did FTIR and we found hexane and pentane and we found eight chain hydrocarbons and not completely saturated, which you said there was a pentene in there, which means it wasn't completely saturated. When you do FTIR, you get this great big mountainous curve on the left-hand side down around 1190 negative centimeters. And it's kind of a jumble of all kinds of hydrocarbons. Yeah, you can see some frequencies in there. I'll tell our listeners a little bit how that works. It's kind of like the laser goes in there and tickles the length of the bonds between the different atoms, and whether they twist or they stretch or they bend, they absorb certain wavelengths of that laser. Well, it's not all that complicated, but if it's absorbing it, then that's very specific to that bond length. However, hydrocarbons are kind of a spaghetti bowl down there at the bottom of the scale. But when you start getting into the higher order things like urethane reactions somewhere around 1,254 nanometers or boron or silica or something like that, some inorganic compound and its reactions with oxygen like siloxane or different things like that, then you get isolated peaks out there that you can see and that you can quantify. But to see boron in something, you can almost bet that it's not going to occur naturally. It's going to have to be manufactured.
Right. What I understand is boron is only about 3 to 10 parts per million of the Earth's crust. It's very rare.
It is usually an alloy used in steel or high tensile magnesium or aluminum. To give you an example about boron, we were going along with electron tubes well up into the 60s, I know. And there was an outfit called Bell Labs. Some of you might be familiar with them. And they had an individual, and I'm not going to mention his name because there's already so much controversy about this. And he was doing research on what's called a rectifier. A rectifier is where you take an AC signal and turn it into a DC by using diodes in a square kind of configuration. Not like a Wheatstone bridge, but so it'll generate a DC signal. All of your converters that run your computer, that run your VCR or your video camera, all these use rectifiers inside of them. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, he patents the transistor. Well, the interesting thing about that is you've got to know how to turn boron into a gas and lay it onto a silicon wafer in order to create a transistor. Bell Labs was not doing any research with gasification of boron. There was only one lab in the world that could do it, and that was in England at the time. So how in the world they came up with this patent, nobody has a clue, other than maybe it was reverse engineering of UFO technology. So when we talk about boron, this is a fairly late player in the technology of man. It's a very unique element.
Well, you know, I tell you, it's amazing to me that they found the same identical thing. I just recounted what they found in Victoria, Australia in 1953. Well, this happened again October 27th in 1954, Florence, Italy. Engineering student collected samples in a jar and took it to Professor Cozzi at his Institute of Chemistry, University of Florence, for analysis. The substance contained such known elements as boron, silicon, magnesium, and calcium.
Really?
Yep, so it's a different continent and a different year.
Well, we just in case our listeners might think that these are spider webs floating on the jet stream or something like that, there are no organic systems, no respiration systems, no web systems, no kind of organic use for boron. It might show up errantly in waste as something that an animal might have eaten or burrowed through, but it's not used in biosystems. So just to let you know, if they're finding boron in these compounds, it is definitely synthetic.
And I've also been told, I talked to a chemist down at North Carolina State that also told me that the carbonyl sulfide is never associated with flora or fauna.
That's right.
That's so exactly there you go, there's right. Another one.
Strictly inorganic processes, and I don't even know, well, I'm not sure because I'm not a complete inorganic chemist, but I'm pretty sure there are no volcanic activities that create or coagulate boron. It pretty much has to be mined.
Right, and while I also understand is there are only several spots that this stuff is actually at the Earth's surface, so it's localized and it's rare.
Right. It's strip mined, a lot like the stuff we use to make ceramic. We use silica. And you might notice this if you have a catalytic converter on your vehicle. Some of the catalytic converters are white and some of them are kind of a off-white or even tan in color. This is because of the region in which the silica is mined. It's all different. And boron is just not a very common element. We don't manufacture boron in the boron factory is what I'm trying to say. It is an element on the periodic chart.
Well, I can tell you that angel hair itself, irregardless of the constituents, its physical properties have been very, very strange as well. I've got, probably six cases where it's been reported to be strong and tough to break, followed by complete sublimation. Now, that, to me, is very odd.
That is odd.
And it leads me to ask, I am not sure. I've also been told that it may be a metastable type of material.
Well, define metastable for us.
Okay, I've got the definition right here. This is from college lecture notes, GO. It's a 3,000 level course, but it says metastability. At each invariant point, there is a region where the univariant curve extends beyond slightly into a third phase region. The reason for this condition is attributed to the additional energy that is required to nucleate a new phase. In the absence of nucleation energy, a metastable phase can persist into another stability region. A common example is supercooled water, achieved by placing a bubble-free container of distilled water in a freezer. When carefully removed from the freezer, a tap with a knife will cause instantaneous crystallization. This is referred to as latent heat of crystallization. In the case of a solid gas transformation, the latent heat of vaporization.
Right.
So I'm not sure. This is something I've just started to explore very recently.
Well, our listeners might not know exactly what all those words mean, but super pure water is just pure H2O. And you'll know that when ice crystals form, they've got to have something around which to coagulate, something to start the ice crystal moving. And if the water is very still, you can actually take it way down below freezing, and it's still liquid. It's not until you agitate it by tapping on it, sending a shock wave through it, or dropping something into it, some impurity into it, that will actually form ice crystals. So I guess what they're implying here, the metastable, is that under certain pure conditions, this angel hair can stay together, can stay physical. But as soon as those conditions vary, or something allows it to begin supplementing, it just comes apart and goes straight into the atmosphere.
Hmm, very interesting.
That's where gas chromatography is very handy, because even for you listeners that should happen to catch some of this stuff, let's say you get it in a quart mason jar, you happen to capture a good wad of it in there, don't worry that it disappears inside the jar. It's not going through the glass. It's not going through that 100% ball lid.
Just don't open it.
Don't open it, because what we'll do when we get it to the lab is we'll drill a tiny hole in the top of that lid, and we'll put a piece of wax over that, and we will do what's called headspace analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Inside that jar are all the components that made up that angel hair. Now, it may not be in the same configuration. The molecules are obviously in gaseous form instead of solid form, but the components, the raw elements, don't change, because elements can neither be created nor destroyed unless you're talking about fusion. Then we might be splitting the atom inside the jar, but I highly doubt that's happening. The interesting thing is, to me, is not that this stuff falls out of the sky, but that it's so closely tied to UFOs. I'm just fascinated by their propulsion systems. I mean, just about every account that I've ever heard of, these things can not only travel at great speeds, but they travel very quietly, and they can make radical turns, which either means the occupants are all slammed up against the driver's window when that thing takes a sharp right turn, or they've got a way to alter their gravitational field inside that craft so that doesn't happen.
Absolutely. I'd totally concur with that. And as a matter of fact, there have been a number of angel hair cases where UFOs were reported to do very radical high-speed maneuvers, such as sharp right-angle turns. Instant acceleration is common. There was a case down in Australia in 1998 where UFOs were lined up equidistant apart, and actually played leapfrog with each other.
Don't tell me they were having fun.
I guess they were having fun. Concurrently, the witnesses report this stuff fell all over the place, covered their... Generally what happens, when this stuff drops from UFOs, if you can imagine, long strands of a silk-like substance, when it falls to Earth, it gets caught on power lines, trees, bushes, you know, anything that'll catch it.
Dr. Agnew?
Yes, sir.
We have someone online. Would you like me to put him through?
Absolutely.
You got it.
Who are we talking with tonight?
Tammy.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Grants Pass, but I'm trying to get on to listen to the radio.
Ah, well, you've reached X Squared Radio, and you're live nationwide with Dr. Brooks Agnew and J. Brian Goldman are both our guests tonight. How are things in Grants Pass?
It's doing fine.
Are you interested in angel hair and UFOs?
Yes, I am. I can't get on to hear it on the radio, so I don't know what to talk about.
Oh, well, I can guarantee you that our technicians can help you with that. But since you're on the radio, maybe you could answer a few questions for us.
I'll try.
Have you ever heard of angel hair before?
No, I haven't.
See, there you go, Brian.
Yeah,
that's why we have to get this word out.
That, absolutely. See, there's the problem. It's mainly a 1950s. Of course, it's occurred throughout the ages, and it's historically documented as such. But it's mainly a 1950s, 1960s phenomenon. It's periodic. It's cyclic. It doesn't happen all the time like UFOs do. And therefore, you know, the last couple of decades, we've had very few cases, and people are not aware, even though they were back in the 50s.
How about that? So, listener, I've been
paying attention since the 50s. I'm an older person. I've been listening or paying attention to UFOs and all this sort of thing since the 50s.
How about that? Well, I find it personally fascinating that when these UFOs come, that they're not completely sterile. They do leave some evidence behind, even if they're just flying around in the air.
Yeah.
So, have you ever seen a UFO before?
No. Are you familiar with Van Tassel?
Yes, I am.
All right. I used to go out in the desert to listen to him talk.
Well, that is going back.
Yeah.
That's wow. Like giant. Was that Giant Rock?
Yeah, Giant Rock. About 1952 or so. 51, 52.
Well, that's not that long ago. I'm old enough to remember that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we used to go out there and at Giant Rock at night and sit out and try to spot UFOs. And when we were there, it never happened.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I've been camping in the Rockies and we've put out the campfire and just laid outside the tent in our sleeping bags and looked up at the sky. Of course,
yeah.
The sky is just full of stars. You can't hardly even make out a constellation. But we've strained our eyes looking for UFOs and
never have
seen one.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
Up there in the sky, the stars, there are stars at night that show up greenish blue, and they're not...
Oh, did we recall her?
I believe we lost him.
Oh.
Hello.
Oh, hey there, he's back.
I'm back again.
Okay, well...
There are stars that are greenish-blue, greenish in color, and they don't seem natural.
Well, that is amazing that you can see that from there because, you know, I was speaking at a observatory one time, and the speaker before me said there's no color in space. Everything is black and white. And I got up afterwards and talked about red shift and blue shift.
Mm-hmm.
What you're seeing there is as stars move away from us, their wavelength stretches out from white to red. It goes from the nice, clean 700 nanometers that we would see as white light, and it stretches out, the wavelength stretches out to about 1100 nanometers toward a red shift.
Gotcha.
Likewise, if the star is moving toward us, like a car honking its horn driving towards you, the sound compresses and it increases in frequency.
It's Doppler shift.
Right.
So,
and
so it gets whiter.
That's called a blue shift. And that's why you will see stars, but I'm pretty amazed that you can see them with the naked eye, although you might be able to up there in Oregon.
Well,
they will have a bluish
here.
Or greenish tint to them.
Yeah, no smog here.
Huh?
Where I am, there's no smog.
Wow. You mean there's a place like that in the United States?
I was going to say.
Well, I got my fire going tonight. We heat with wood here, with wood here out in the sticks. So.
No heating oil problems for you.
No, right.
You must have good eyesight, sir, because I've got a 10-inch Schmidt Cass telescope. Mead, as a matter of fact, and I can barely make out the color differences myself with it.
Oh, yeah? Well, I could probably walk out in the backyard and see at least three, maybe four stars that are greenish in color.
Yeah. They're out there. Especially if you look up towards Orion Nebula, you'll see some. If you use a 10-inch is a good scope, but we've got a 25-inch out here, and it gathers a lot of light.
Wow.
When you look up at the Orion Nebula, it's all kinds of blues and
green.
I hate to break in on y'all, and you sound like you're having so much fun, and there are so many listeners out there right now. But unfortunately, we do have another show coming up here in a couple minutes. Just wanted to let you know.
We've only been on the air for about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I know.
What's wrong with that?
We're only allowed an hour, and an hour goes so fast. Well, listen, I want to thank my guest, J. Brian Boldman. I will definitely have you back on the program if you're willing.
Absolutely.
And thank you, listener in Grants Pass. Awesome, awesome attention. We love it. And Don, my technician and mentor at bbsradio.com, we appreciate all your help tonight. And don't forget, this is X Squared Radio, and we will be back again at 9 p.m. Central Time next Wednesday when I return from Mexico City. Thank you all, and good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.